You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the historic and political echoes of next week's Kavanaugh hearing.
This is a huge development overnight and sets up a direct conflict with Republicans in the Senate and the White House.
Democrats have to be cognizant of overreaching.
That said, there is still time for the Republicans on that committee or in leadership to mess this up.
The way it went down is very curious.
We're going to end up with a he said, she said, and no one will be able to say the other's lying or telling the truth.
Speculation about Monday's hearing will be all-consuming over the next few days. That's if Dr. Ford decides to show up on Monday. And the historic references are hard to miss. Christine Blasey Ford has probably given some thought to how Anita Hill prepared for the testimony she gave in 1991.
It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration and great number of sleepless nights that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone but my close friends.
Professor Hill wrote in the first line of an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, "There is no way to redo 1991, but there are ways to do better." And that's what we're going to talk about. As our guest joins us, I'd like to hear your questions and your consideration on what happens next. Is the delay of a confirmation vote appropriate? How confident are you that the senators conducting this hearing on Monday, if it happens, have learned anything from 1991 and the Me Too movement today? So questions and thoughts about delaying the confirmation vote and how confident you are that senators now get it, because a whole lot of women ran in 1992 saying that they didn't in the wake of the Anita Hill situation. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Kimberly Atkins is with us. She's chief Washington correspondent and columnist for the Boston Herald, and she joins us from D.C. And Kimberly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Do you now have a sense of the parameters of the hearing? I mean, I know it's changing kind of hour to hour. What do you know today that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, as we stand right now, the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee have scheduled a hearing, on Monday, where they have invited both Judge Brett Kavanaugh and also Dr. Christine Blasey Ford to come testify about Dr. Ford's allegation that Kavanaugh attacked her when they were in high school and in a very aggressive sexual way. But right now, the Democrats on that committee, as well as Ford herself, are saying before she testifies, they want the FBI to reopen their background investigation into Brett Kavanaugh in order to vet these allegations, talk to witnesses who were there or who may have some information to share on this, and really vet this before it goes before a committee, potentially on live television. And so right now, that's the standoff between the two sides.
Do you have the sense, it appears that whatever the FBI is saying about this is being filtered through chairs of the committee or the president? Do we have any kind of objective view of whether the FBI is willing to do this or not?
Well, yes. So the answer is the FBI could reopen this at the request of the White House. The White House could ask the FBI to say, look, can you vet these things just as you vetted other aspects of Brett Kavanaugh's background? There's historical precedent for that. That is something that happened after Anita Hill came forward with allegations of sexual harassment against now Justice Clarence Thomas. It's worth remembering that FBI probe had not been completed at the time that Anita Hill did end up testifying.
Wow, I didn't know that. Huh.
Before the committee. But at least that had been in place because that was something that was called on by the White House. So the White House does have that power to do it. It seems so far that President Trump is not in any way inclined to do that. He said, not quite correctly, that the FBI said that that's just something they don't do. They're the FBI. The I stands for investigation. That is exactly what they do. But it seems at this point that's not something the president is inclined to do. We've heard from some members of the committee, including Lindsey Graham, this morning, who said that it should not be an FBI investigation, that either the parties testify or the committee moves on to a vote next week.
And so you have it sounds like you have the sense that Monday is the day. And now in some ways, the ball is back in Christine Blasey Ford's court to decide whether she's going to show on Monday or not, even if there is an FBI. Even if the FBI doesn't step in to investigate further, she's been given an invitation and there is this sense developing that you either show up or we do the vote.
Yes. I mean, as this is set up, and this is the Senate, it's a political body. This is not a court of law or anything like that. It's a political body. And the way that I described it in my piece today is that it's sort of a political game of chicken. You have both sides standing firm in their positions, the Democrats saying no testimony without an FBI probe, the Republicans saying you either testify on Monday or we move on. There's political peril on both sides. You have the Democrats could sort of miss an opportunity to get this story told. A vote could move forward and that can be the end of that. Mm-hmm. You also have Republicans, if they do that, particularly in the current climate of Me Too and Time's Up, that they could really run the risk of looking as if they're pushing forward a process, rushing it through, and not giving the claims claims about a sexual attack a full vetting for the sake of getting their chosen nominee on the bench. So there are political perils. There's also, remember, too, there's a human story being told here on the part of Dr. Ford. She has received death threats. She and her family have had to leave their home. It seems that in the aftermath of her coming forward for the first time publicly last weekend in the Washington Post, her life has been upended. This is something else that should be weighed in all of this.
I saw her lawyer on CNN last night, and her lawyer was saying what you've just mentioned. They've had to move out of their house. She's concerned about threats to her family and her children, and she's taking care of that. Juxtapose that with, and yet there is this deadline of Monday, and this might mm-hmm. be her only opportunity. Now I see, I mean, this is tough no matter where you are politically in the Senate, right? You want to hear her, and yet who can't empathize with what she's going through?
It's true. I mean, it sort of shows the one way that this Senate process is imperfect in trying to vet a claim like this. It's really difficult. And while you have the desire to not want to stall this indefinitely and move forward, there's also a strong desire to give a reasonable chance for all the parties to be able to tell their stories and to try to, as best as you can with the 35-year-old allegation, get to the bottom of all of the facts that are possible to be known and make sure that the members of the Senate have that before moving forward. We have to see again which side, one side or another, has to budge, or this is going to a vote.
There was a moment yesterday when Senator Collins, and I want to talk to you about this, Kimberly, in a minute, how important Senator Murkowski and Collins are, and possibly Jeff Flake in this. But Senator Collins suggested that she wanted Dr. Ford's lawyer to be able to question Judge Kavanaugh during the hearing, which introduces a kind of courtroom procedure element to this. I mean, she's an important player in this. Was there serious consideration given to that? And is that off the table, even if Dr. Ford decides to come forward on Monday?
Yeah, it's unclear exactly how this will play out. The thought is that one reason that they are suggesting that other people come in and do the questioning is to avoid the visual of Senate Judiciary Committee Republicans, which is a group of all men, being seen as grilling this woman who is coming forward publicly for the first time.
I mean, this is echoes of Anita Hill.
Exactly, exactly. And at that time, when Anita Hill came forward, there were no women on the Senate Judiciary Committee at all. At least today, there are four women on the Democratic side. And back then, there were only two women in the entire Senate. So that's the difference. And as you alluded in the beginning, there was sort of a year of the woman that followed in 1992, where a lot of women were elected to office, including people like Dianne Feinstein, who is now the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. She was elected that following year. And one of the impetus, one impetus of that was seen as those Anita Hill hearings that sort of showed the patriarchal nature of the U.S. Senate and a desire to get more women on.
Which has changed somewhat, but hasn't completely changed. Just a note here. So in 1991, when Anita Hill testified, Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, he supported Anita Hill's testimony. He was on the committee. Chuck Grassley, who's now chairing the committee, as you mentioned, Dianne Feinstein, and Joe Biden, right, was on the committee and took a lot of heat for the way this looked and the way the senators behaved to Anita Hill. This also contributes to this idea of political peril, right?
Right, right. And Dianne Feinstein was elected the year after.
She
was elected.
Got it. Thank you.
1992. But yes, Joe Biden, one thing that he has continued to express regret about is his handling of the Anita Hill allegations, that he did things like he disallowed other witnesses who had experienced similar treatment, who claimed to have experienced similar treatment by Clarence Thomas, to come forward and testify publicly. So it was only Anita Hill that we saw speaking publicly. He said he regretted that. And these are the things that Senate Democrats and Republicans right now are probably thinking about. They're going over history and seeing what was done right and what was done wrong as they consider how to proceed forward.
If you're listening to the show, you've just joined the conversation. We're getting a sense of the procedural way forward from Kimberly Atkins with this situation on the Kavanaugh hearings. Kimberly is chief Washington correspondent and columnist for the Boston Herald. You hear her somewhat frequently on our air. I wanted to find out, how do things look this morning on Capitol Hill, with a lot of questions still being raised? And as she points out, the Senate is a political body, and so there are a lot of political considerations swirling. So Kimberly giving us a sense of that. We're going to bring two guests in now. Chara Torres is with us. She's a professor of law at Stetson College of Law. Chara, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And in a bit, we'll hear from Walter Olson, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He'll also join us from D.C. Okay, Chara, so you've heard Kimberly and I talking a bit about the political considerations here. I wondered if you had more observation on why Republicans are proceeding the way they are and some of the peril that they may be in, no matter which way they go.
Well, I guess it's worth remembering that this nominee is taking Justice Kennedy's seat on the Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy was a swing vote for many hot-button issues, and just the potential of a Justice Kavanaugh could change the way that the Supreme Court looks at a number of issues. So whether it's abortion and reproductive health, marriage equality for gay Americans, gun control, gerrymandering, or affirmative action. In all of those topics I just listed, Judge Kavanaugh is to the right of where Justice Kennedy was. And so you could have a tidal shift in the way laws are considered by the Supreme Court if Kavanaugh is actually elevated to the Supreme Court.
I think you've just nicely set up why this is so important to Republicans to keep pushing this through, accelerating, right, these hearings, and plus the Supreme Court session starts in early October. But you've also indicated, Chara, why this is, why Democrats look at this as such a monumental selection and choice and decision.
Indeed. And so the stakes are very high on both sides, because the fate of the Supreme Court is in the balance here. And another thing that sort of just strikes me is we are in this Me Too moment. I was just looking up the statistics before I got on air with you. 1 in 6 women have experienced sexual violence, and a lot of those women are voters, mm-hmm. and we have an election in 48 days. And so I think both sides are very worried about how this is going to play out for their side of the electorate.
Anita Hill, Kimberly, suggested in this Times op-ed that was published yesterday that only a, quote, fair and neutral way to do this would be the way to proceed. And she says, select a neutral investigative body with experience in sexual misconduct cases that will investigate the incident in question and present its findings to the committee. Why couldn't they do that other than the deadlines? Why couldn't they do that? That would satisfy a lot of people, wouldn't it?
Yes, and the answer is they can. I mean, they could, as is being requested, have the FBI look into this again. They could find some sort of third party to vet the testimony of both Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford and other witnesses who are pertinent. They could do that. But there is an election coming up, and there is the political consideration on the Republican side that there is a slight but real possibility that they could lose control of the Senate. And if that happens, then that could imperil not only Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, but any other person that President Trump nominates to the court. I think that's the thing that's overriding all of this.
If you have questions as you listen in to the conversation here about what happens next, what's happening with the confirmation process, and how confident you are that the senators conducting this hearing have learned something from 1991, this is something I want to talk to Chara Torres about as well, and the Me Too movement today, how confident are you that the people going through this in Washington on Capitol Hill have gotten it, have figured it out since then? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Chara Torres, where Rob says the committee is trying to isolate Ford and Kavanaugh to a he said, she said, to shame her claims and question her memory. But there were witnesses, just like Anita Hill, that can verify the claims. That's shameful to ignore the truth and rush it through. Can you speak to how you see a different atmosphere in D.C. with, you know, with this specter of what happened with Anita Hill hanging over it?
Well, I guess we'll all see whether we've learned any lessons from 1991 and the Anita Hill testimony. At the time, I was in an all-girls school, not unlike probably the schools that Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford went to. And to my school's credit, they actually set up a big screen TV and
really?
Let us, we're on, a break from class. We could watch the Anita Hill testimony.
Wow.
And I remember lots of my female classmates being just horrified about what Anita Hill said, Clarence Thomas had said to her about pornography. And then we watched Clarence Thomas get elevated to the Supreme Court. So it is entirely possible that what we are about to see on Monday, if that hearing goes forward, is a repeat of history. So I'm not particularly optimistic that we have learned the lessons from 1991.
You mentioned some of the testimony that Anita Hill gave, including some pretty explicit testimony as relating some of the things that Clarence Thomas said to her. Here's a bit of that testimony.
After a brief discussion of work, he would turn the conversation to a discussion of sexual matters. His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes.
Anita Hill, in 1991, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, to the phones to Mark in Minneapolis. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, the way Senator Feinstein has handled this, after receiving the information prior to the hearings, to not ask for an investigation, to not ask for anything other than, well, to just hide this information until after the hearings have ended and a vote is about to take place, and then to throw it out there. Now, I've been a Democrat my whole life, and we've always taken the high road on these things. This is shameful. This is somebody who for 30 years has an impeccable record. There are liberals who support.
You're talking about Brett Kavanaugh. Yes.
Yeah.
So,
and for this kind of, this is, could you imagine what happens now after some anonymous Republican goes after Cory Booker, or some anonymous Republican goes after, this is crazy the way that we're governing this country now.
So Mark, two good points there. I'm going to put the first question to Kimberly about how Dianne Feinstein decided to handle this and what Christine Ford was asking her to do. Kim?
So the background is that Dr. Ford contacted first a member of Congress and then Dianne Feinstein about her allegation sometime in July. At that time, Dr. Ford was asked for confidentiality and for that information not to be shared. Dianne Feinstein says that there was no other way for her to move forward unless she did come forward with a name and come forward, and protecting her confidentiality prohibited her from moving forward, and that it was only after the report of the letter that she sent was reported in the media, and later she was identified by reporters who began showing up at her door, that she herself agreed to come forward. And at that point, she could move forward. Up until then, Dianne Feinstein had only shared this letter she passed it on to the FBI and also shared it subsequently, actually, with other members of the committee. So that is the point. I would just make one point about, as the caller called, imagine an anonymous mm-hmm. Republican. At this point, Dr. Ford is no longer anonymous. And I think, especially given what has happened to her, anybody is perfectly free to disagree with the way that Senator Feinstein handled this. But I think to characterize Dr. Ford as an anonymous Democrat or some Democratic operative, given what has happened to her life, I personally fail to see what she has personally to gain and how for her personally, keeping someone off the Supreme Court is worth the price that she has already paid, having not even spoken at a public hearing yet about her allegation.
Chara, to that last point, I was reading a piece in the Times this morning, and they were quoting Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge, and she's been writing about women's rights and sexual harassment. And she said this: "I would be very troubled if someone were about to go to jail for something like this that happened 40 years ago. With respect to the Supreme Court, you're dealing with an elite position, which is a privilege to be confirmed for, and arguably the standards are much higher." As a professor of law, can you weigh in on that?
Sure. So for sexual assault in most states, there is a statute of limitations, and this would be well beyond the statute of limitations. But the question is not whether they're going to haul Brett Kavanaugh off to prison. It's whether it's appropriate to put this individual in one of the only 9 slots there are on the Supreme Court, where he will have life tenure. And historically, there has been no impeachment of any Supreme Court justice. So even if you, we get a blue wave in this fall's election and in 2020, whoever is appointed to the Supreme Court is likely to be there for the rest of their life. And thus, as you said, it's an elite position. We want people there with who are moral. And if Dr. Ford's accusation is accurate, I don't think that that word can be applied to this individual.
Chara, thank you so much. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the show. Chara Torres-Spelsey is a professor of law at Stetson College of Law, joining us this morning from Gulfport, Florida. Kimberly Atkins continues with us. She's chief Washington correspondent and columnist for the Boston Herald. And Walter Olson will join us from the Cato Institute to continue more conversation about the politics of this. And Walter, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Hey, I want to ask you about something that has popped up quickly in our conversation, and that's callers and listeners concerned about the delay of this. Kimberly gave us what Senator Feinstein is saying. Look, I was asked to keep the confidentiality of Christine Ford. I did that. And now she's being criticized by many Republicans and some Americans for not having brought this forward. How do you see it, and how do you think it'll influence what happens next?
Well, the Republicans, many of them are feeling blindsided, feeling that if anyone on the Democratic side knew about it, then it should have been brought forward. I'm still withholding judgment because Feinstein has also signaled that she thought that in the state of the evidence as it was then, this was not something to bring forward. It could be that the change in Dr. Ford's own willingness to step forward and talk about it was enough of a change to that, you know, if she had signaled that earlier, that Senator Feinstein might have treated it differently. So, as I say, I'm withholding judgment as to whether or not people on the Democratic side should have handled it differently until we know a little more.
And then let me ask you this, given the fact that you're still waiting to learn more, do you think it would have changed anything if Senator Feinstein had been able to persuade Christine Ford, let me take this to the FBI or let me share this with members of the committee? Can you see a different path for Kavanaugh?
Again, those are imponderables. As far as taking it to the FBI, it would then more likely have been included in his file, at which point a lot of different things could happen. Whether or not the FBI found any more information, it could have led to lines of questioning, lines of investigation, whether open or behind the scenes, that could have brought us further along by this point to questions that we still haven't had answered, like, you know, is there any testimony from others who were at the party? You know, we're only now finding out some things that might have been found out weeks ago. So, yeah, that no telling where it might have led. It might have, if the Kavanaugh supporters are right, might have led it decisively to rest by this point, or if the Ford supporters are right, might have decisively brought out more evidence for what she's saying. Again, it's
impossible to know. I know
that something could be done differently, but it's very frustrating to have scheduled a vote basically and then have an accusation come out this late in the day.
Kimberly, I'm sure there's discussion about this. What if we'd had more time? Can you give me a sense of what people are saying about that?
Yeah, I mean, more time. There is no deadline put on.
Well, that's a good point, right?
The nomination process of a Supreme Court justice. One thing that's being brought up frequently is the fact that President Obama's last nominee, Merrick Garland, his nomination was stalled for more than a year by Republicans who just didn't want to move forward before the election. So there is no timetable other than the political one that comes in the form of the upcoming midterms, which is clearly a motivator, probably for both sides in this political battle that we're seeing over this. But there is time if the parties are interested to set up some sort of system to vet these allegations more thoroughly before members of the Judiciary Committee and or the greater Senate, the full Senate, votes on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination.
Call here from Leslie in Duluth. Hi, Leslie. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I am reflecting on the whole Clarence Thomas issue, that if we really want to set the record straight, I feel that he should resign to show the, or to support the Me Too movement and the validity of Anita Hill's testimony.
Walter Olson, we should remember that Justice Thomas denied it then, denies it now, right? He has never acceded to the allegations that Anita Hill made.
So, as you said, there is no reason from Justice Thomas's view that he should do anything of the sort. He considers himself to have been unfairly accused. He has stuck to that position ever since. And in the absence of the very significant different evidence that would probably not change his mind, but somehow change the Senate's mind, that's where it's going to stay. The public had a long, long airing, which in many ways came out favorably for what Anita Hill was hoping to accomplish. But one thing that it did not do is keep him off the court. That has not changed, and I don't think it will change.
I want to understand why you said it came up favorably. Are you referring, for Anita Hill, you're referring to what happened politically? I mean, she did not feel very well treated
Let me name two areas. One is that in later public opinion, she was generally seen as having done a sincere thing, a brave thing. Even people who supported Justice Thomas's confirmation often thought, she was doing right by her own lights. Secondly, the law changed. Not too long after the Anita Hill hearings, the federal employment law, Congress considerably liberalized it, making it much easier to proceed with harassment complaints. And that was widely blamed or credited, depending on whether you liked the law, on the Anita Hill episode. So that, what she did there, left her with a lot of public esteem and respect, and changed the law. It did not keep the justice off the court. So was that a victory or was that a defeat? I mean, history may say.
Yeah. She wrote in this op-ed that I've been referring to in the Times, "Today the public expects better from our government than we got in 1991 when our representatives performed in ways that gave employers permission to mishandle workplace harassment complaints throughout the following decades." Walter, does that shade your thoughts here about what followed and how good she feels about it?
No, I'm not presuming to say how she feels about it. I'm trying to
you're saying objectively
guess how history will pronounce on it. And I think that she doesn't feel that enough was done in response to her testimony, and
right.
That's understandable. It didn't keep him off the court. She felt that was a rebuke in some sense. From the standpoint of whether or not what she did had some significant historical results in the direction she was hoping, I'd say she may be underselling some of the impact that she had on the country. She did have very real impact.
Yeah, Kimberly, I'm cognizant, though, and I hear what Walter is saying. There was a big push to change employment law, but I also remember that not too long ago, taxpayers were funding payoffs when members of Congress were being accused of sexual harassment. I don't know how much has changed on Capitol Hill.
Right. And there is a concern that although there have been changes, the Anita Hill episode did bring the issue of sexual harassment to the fore in a way that it wasn't really treated as a serious thing before. But that being said, there is still a system in place, both in many workplaces and also in our government, that that actually protects the people in power against people with less power who make these kinds of claims. It's very difficult. And even if you look at the words of the president today, just touting how respected and what a great career that Judge Kavanaugh would have, and it would be a shame if he's treated unfairly. It seems to be that the levers of power are such that they protect the people in power and make it a lot more difficult for other people who don't hold those positions of power to make these allegations.
Call here from Pam in Hopkins, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Yeah, what's your question?
I have a statement for Kimberly. It seems that Dr. Ford's credibility is in question, or that people seem to think that she came forward just like last week with this statement about Brett Kavanaugh. And my understanding is there's been an entire process, like this just wasn't announced yesterday, and that, you know, she is credible and there are statements that were made to back her, you know, allegations.
Kimberly, what would you say?
Yeah. So according to Dr. Ford in the report that was done by The Washington Post, there was a process. She first notified her member of Congress, then Senator Dianne Feinstein. In the ensuing weeks, she expressed some concern about what it might do to her life, what it might do to her family if she were to come forward. And she wavered, went back and forth, really struggling with that decision. When it started to become clear that coming forward may be her only option, she did things like got a hold of therapist notes. When she went to therapy, she said over the years she had really struggled with this incident and found that it was affecting her life in a way that she sought therapy for it years ago. And there are notes from that therapist that back up her account of recounting this episode years ago. She also took a polygraph test. Polygraphs aren't admissible in courts of law, but they are used by the FBI in investigations to help vet the credibility of witnesses. And so she voluntarily did that. She seemed to have been trying to do everything that she can to protect her credibility and to do what she could to seem credible, making an allegation all of these years later. That appears to be also her motivation for wanting the FBI to vet this. Of course, if you go before the FBI and you lie, that's a felony. So the fact that she's willing to do that, I think, is another effort to bolster her credibility here. That being said, it's extremely difficult to prove that something that happened 36 years ago happened. So I think in that sense, she's doing all that she can. It won't be seen as sufficient by some, but those are the limitations to the situation.
Senator Grassley on CNN this morning saying, and other networks saying, that there will be no FBI probe. Walter, I know the polls are coming on this. Do you suspect that public opinion will pretty much divide along political lines as to, yes, we can believe her and they ought to give her more time to tell her story, and no, get it done, she's somebody who's being manipulated by Democrats, or, you know, that kind of line of thinking?
The partisans definitely already have lined up that way. One big difference between this and the Anita Hill episode, though, is in the Anita Hill episode, she went and gave testimony that was televised, and that was a big national event. And a lot of people who had either been on the fence or leaning one way saw the testimony and either changed their view or became much more confident, because that's what testimony in person does. And that's why the Republicans are pressing for, look, serious accusations require serious evidence. Come here on Monday and you can either have a private session or you can have a public session, your choice. But watching you testify and watching you answer critical questions, just as with Anita Hill, will make all the difference in whether a lot of people in the middle wind up saying, yes, we're putting on the button, I believe, Christine Ford.
Yeah. We've been referring back to Anita Hill's testimony and playing a few excerpts from it, and so in line with what Walter has said about the power of that personal testimony and what it means to Americans to watch that, here's one more excerpt from the Hill testimony.
On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. Because I was extremely uncomfortable talking about sex with him at all, and particularly in such a graphic way, I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects. I would also try to change the subject to education matters or to non-sexual personal matters, such as his background or his beliefs. My efforts to change the subject were rarely successful.
Anita Hill in 1991, and a call here from Katrina in Minneapolis. Hi, Katrina.
Hello. I have a question about Brett Kavanaugh. I'm frustrated that he flat out denies it, and I'm wondering if there is actually an FBI investigation. What happens if he is proven wrong?
Walter, it doesn't sound like there's going to be an investigation, but take that line of thinking, will you, and explore it.
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, the people who are directly interviewed by the FBI may be under penalties of perjury for the things that they say to the FBI. In general, telling untruths or arguable untruths in other circumstances produces other kinds of sanctions. If you are up for a Supreme Court seat and people believe you haven't told the truth, they will probably vote against you if they're senators, whether or not there's some other legal penalty. So as far as the big thing that they're fighting over, if anyone establishes to a senator's satisfaction that Kavanaugh has not been telling the truth, then they will probably win the confirmation battle. But in the meantime, you've got the question of what an FBI investigation would add to the Senate's ability to call witnesses, both the Kavanaugh and Ford, and anyone who can be placed at the scene of the events, which includes at least one and possibly two other people at this point.
Walter, I really appreciate the time and the last-minute turnaround. Thank you much for that.
My pleasure.
Walter Olson with us, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Kimberly Atkins continues with us from the Boston Herald. Kim, I know you're a busy woman. I really appreciate the time this morning. A few more questions, if you can.
Sure.
To Mira in Minneapolis. Hi, Mira.
Hi, Carrie. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to bring up the issue that this isn't limited to Dr. Ford, what we've heard in reporting on The Intercept online, and it has not been denied, interestingly, that there are many federal court employees, I shouldn't say many, several federal court employees who worked with Judge Kavanaugh, not when he was in high school, but when he was a law clerk and also a judge, along with being then later on going on to hire Judge Kaczynski's son. And that whole episode, which lasted many, many years, and these are federal court employees that spent 8 to 10 hours with a judge who want to be heard but reached out to the Judiciary Committee, are not allowed to be being heard. And just as a citizen, that doesn't pass the smell test to me.
Mm-hmm.
There should be something done about that, or their concerns should at least be looked into to see if they have merit, if they don't have merit. But these are people who, according to their own accounts, have faced retaliation from Judge Kaczynski and others in that.
Are you saying, Mira, Kaczynski? Do you mean Kavanaugh or do you mean Kaczynski?
I mean, Judge Kaczynski is the one who. That's the episode to which Judge Kavanaugh his own conduct is implicated on whether or not what he knew, what he didn't know. But these are people who want to talk about Judge Kavanaugh.
Yes,
their
got
experience
it.
As federal court employees with Judge Kavanaugh during that Kaczynski episode, but also otherwise.
Got it. Kimberly, my understanding is there will be no other witnesses other than Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford if she decides to come on Monday.
And as it stands now, that seems to be the case, according to Senator Grassley, the chairman of the committee. When it comes to this particular episode, the allegation of Dr. Ford, there are a couple of other people who she says were there and so far through statements have indicated an unwillingness to testify, saying that they simply don't know. They don't have a recollection of this. Not quite a denial, but we'll see what happens there. When it comes to the Kaczynski allegations, Judge Kavanaugh did clerk and remain close to Judge Kaczynski. Two quick points there. One is that this did come up during the confirmation. So I think that the answer, whether or not witnesses were brought forward from the at least the Republican leaders on the committee is saying that is would be that's been vetted. We've already gone through that and that's closed. That's not new information. But it does bear it is relevant in that there are a lot of people coming forward and saying, oh, well, I've known Judge Kavanaugh for years and he's a great guy. And he's not the guy who I hear described by in this incident. Remember that Kavanaugh himself said, claimed, according to his own testimony, that he was unaware of the misconduct that Judge Kaczynski allegedly committed that cost him his judgeship. And he was very close to him. So by that admission, it's very easy to see that somebody who you think is a wonderful person might have done something or might be continuing to do something that you just don't know about.
On Twitter, a listener says, we should all pause and ask ourselves, if this happened to our daughter, I'm a father of three girls, wouldn't we be asking for as much time as possible to get all the facts? And to the phones to Julia in Minneapolis. Hi, Julia.
Hi. I guess I heard you say, someone say earlier that all of the partisans have kind of lined up.
And yeah.
I feel like I'm one of those people who does not want to see Kavanaugh on the court at all. So to judge this situation, the only way I can think about it fairly is to consider how would I feel if this were a man I very much wanted to see on the court.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I come to the conclusion that I want to live in a world where redemption is possible and where people won't be judged by their very worst moment, their very worst behavior at age 17, drunk. And so to me, what he says about this means a lot. I don't want to see him on the court either way, but I will view him differently if he testifies, I drank a lot
right.
in high school. I may have done some awful things, and I may not remember this. That's a very different thing to say than to say, didn't happen, did not happen, no way.
Yeah, Julia, this is exactly what we were talking about in the newsroom yesterday afternoon, is we don't have the kind of political arena where somebody could say, you know, I might have been blackout drunk, or I had a problem then, and the rest of my life I've spent time learning from that experience. Kimberly, I think that's impossible, even if Brett Kavanaugh would want to say, it might have happened, the rest of my life has been dedicated to correcting some of the idiotic things I did as a high school student.
Yes, and that's a major part of this entire discussion, I think the national discussion that's happening over this, is how do you judge the character of somebody who is a teenager?
Right.
On the one hand, as your caller said, we should believe in redemption and the ability to learn from our mistakes and move forward. On the other hand, in many states, the acts committed by a 17-year-old would have that person in the criminal justice system as an adult.
That's right.
And treat it that way. So it is this idea not only about the lapse of time, but the age of the people involved at the time, how we treat people when they've lived successful lives, how much that bears on an allegation of wrongdoing. These are hard questions.
Kimberly, I really appreciate the time. I know you're busy on a day like this. Thank you. Thanks for the insight and the reporting experience.
My pleasure.
Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington correspondent and columnist for the Boston Herald. If there is a hearing on Monday, we are going to take it live from NPR News. We'll let you know.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.